Welcome to Thoughts on Record, official podcast of the Ottawa Institute of Cognitive Behavioral Therapy. Each episode, we explore topics of interest to clinicians and mental health consumers from a cognitive behavioral perspective. I'm your host, Dr. Pete Kelly.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the podcast. Fred Luskin, PhD, is director of the Stanford Forgiveness Project, an ongoing series of workshops and research projects that investigate the effectiveness of his forgiveness methods on a variety of populations. The Forgiveness Project has successfully explored forgiveness therapy with people who have suffered from the violence in Northern Ireland, Sierra Leone, as well as the attacks on the World Trade Center on 9/11. In addition, his work has been successfully applied in research in corporate, medical, legal, and religious settings. He currently serves as a senior consultant in health promotion at Stanford University and is a professor at the Institute of Transpersonal Psychology. He presents lectures, workshops, seminars, and training on the importance, health benefits, and training of forgiveness, stress management, and emotional competence throughout the United States. He is author of Forgive for Good, A Proven Prescription for Health and Happiness, as well as Stress-Free for Good, 10 Proven Life Skills for Health and Happiness with co-author Kenneth Peltier, PhD. All right, Dr. Fred Luskin, welcome so much to Thoughts on Record. How are you doing today?
I'm doing fine, thank you.
So, Dr. Luskin, I'm absolutely delighted to have you on the podcast today. Your book, Forgive for Good, is truly one of my most recommended books to clients. And I think clinicians in private practice, such as myself, who are apt to see lots of clients struggling with interpersonal and workplace-related stressors, it really provides an absolutely invaluable model for conceptualizing and ultimately working through really incredibly common, but also quite impactful stressors for our clients. As I hope we might be able to get into later, I also think there's tremendous applicability of your model to the processing of trauma as well. And, you know, finally, I think your forgiveness model has tremendous utility for us clinicians working through our own reactions to really difficult situations with clients. So I guess to start, and I'm so feel so lucky to be able to troubleshoot some of these issues with you that I've wondered about in reading the book and helping clients with it. Quite frequently, when I recommend Forgive for Good, a common reaction that I encounter, despite a lot of upfront explanation and the really nice preamble in the book around this, is that clients are concerned that I'm asking them to be okay with something that is not okay, to forget something that should never be forgotten, to minimize their own hurt when they are rightly seeking validation. How does your model define or conceptualize forgiveness? And what have you found to be an effective way of navigating what I think is a really quite an understandable reaction to a word that can have a lot of ambiguity around what it actually means?
Well, the key word that you use is ambiguity. And I would agree with that. And I would also articulate the idea of yes and. That something can be unwanted, painful, disruptive, traumatic, and be recoverable from. So what happens is people get locked into the, this is wrong, this is bad, this hurts me, but they lose the and piece. So forgiveness isn't no. It's not those terrible things. It's yes and. It's very painful, maybe even unprovoked, maybe even awful things have happened to you. And that in no way means that's the end of your life or the end of your happiness, or even that that's the last word on the event. So forgiveness is giving people some flexibility in their ability to navigate their own life, which their story and their hostility, they have cut down their own maneuverability, and you're trying to give it back to them. So that would be my answer to you. What are you offering people? They will try to hook you into, isn't this terrible? And if you disagree in any way, they will tell you, well, what's wrong with you? Don't you know how terrible this is? And what you're doing is neither agreeing nor disagreeing with the terrible, but you're commenting on their stuckness in a terrible response to their situation.
Now, what are some of the preconditions for forgiveness? And I have some questions for you, well, I'll get to in a few minutes, just around where people don't seem to be able to initiate this process that we're talking about.
Yeah.
But just to set up those questions just a little bit more, what are some of the preconditions that need to be in place in order for someone to start a journey of forgiveness and to take advantage and liberate some of that flexibility that you're talking about?
I mean, we came up with three very basic ones for our work many years ago. But the basic conception is you want to grieve before you forgive. That's the basic part of, I believe, healthy healing from difficulty. And you don't want to minimize or disrupt grieving. And you don't want to make it seem like grieving is like the not as important part. Grieving is essential. What can happen to people, though, is they get stuck in grieving. That, you know, they talk about uncomplicated or complicated grief. Well, uncomplicated grief is really a healthy process. And I believe it's how our brain and nervous system reintegrate new information into our schema and coping so that we can move ahead in life. And it's absolutely essential that we do that. However, many people get stuck in that grieving process and it becomes perseverative, you know, where just the same old all the time, or it becomes physically damaging where they're stressing their bodies out, or they create a story around themselves of almost endless victimization. At that point, the grieving process has halted. And that's when you can, like, somewhat feel free to start intervening to help people, like, unstick the grieving process. That's when you intervene with forgiveness. The three conditions that we kind of came up with were: can you at least articulate clearly what the harm was to you? Like, be really clear about it. Like, not that my dad was a schmuck for hitting me, but what actually did he do to you? And what was the damage that still exists? So, like, a harm assessment, because you have to know what it is you're forgiving. Second, you need to have experienced some of the Elizabeth Kubler-Ross say stages of grieving. Like, if you're just furious for 6 months, you probably haven't explored your feelings enough to move on. You need to feel the vulnerability of sadness, of doubt, of uncertainty, of bargaining. You know, you need to go through the human range of experience. So if you're a therapist and you're with somebody who a year and a half after their husband has walked out on them, and they're still like spitting piss and vinegar and telling you what the shithead is doing, and they're still angry a year and a half later, then you might not jump directly to forgiveness. You might do some therapeutic work to uncover the loss and sadness. And then you can say, okay, you've explored the territory here, so you're good. And the last piece, and this is important, is you want to make sure that people have talked it out to a couple of other human beings before you tell them to move on. Like, that people need support and they need a way to take the concepts that are in their head and make them vocal. So those are the three preconditions that we tried to do to itemize exactly what it requires for people to be okay to start exploring letting go of the victimization and the resentment.
I have a number of clients who I practice in Ottawa, Canada. We're a government town. The federal government's here. And we have a lot of clients that end up embroiled in these long, like sometimes decades long grievances or administrative or bureaucratic processes, right? Where they're sort of never ending. There's not an end where they can start to do that grief work.
Right.
Do you see utility for your model in that kind of a context where the person may have to adapt to a set of sort of unacceptable conditions for the foreseeable future? Can the forgiveness model have a utility in that context?
I'm gonna give you not quite a direct answer to that because it's not the question that I would ask, but I'm going to give you two ancillary answers. One, human beings are always responding to their environment. Always. So it's not unusual. It's not like, wow, because I have to adapt, something different has happened. That's not true. We all have to adapt. We have to adapt to getting older. We have to adapt to having kids. We have to adapt to getting sick. We have to adapt to changing jobs. It's not necessarily honest to create a grievance around the fact that you have to adapt. I mean, that's part of life. So I wouldn't hold that as important as some people would try to make it. Like adaptation, that's the essence of homeostasis. You know, you have an organism that has to adapt to its environment, both physically and psychologically. So that I would put, I wouldn't give a pity party because they have to adapt to life. I would normalize that and say, yeah, that's absolutely true. And that's true in a lot of circumstances. And you want to use this as good training in that so that if it ever happens again, you don't have to be stuck in your resistance. Like, you know, you normalize it and positivize it. But the second piece is, and this is like, I'm going to say, an adaptation of Dr. Phil's, like, how's that working for you? And I think that is a crucial test for mental health, that to simply, without rancor, ask people, well, how's your coping? How is this coping? How's it working out for you? Is it helping you? Is it useful? Are you feeling happy from it? Are you free of problems? Blah, 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 blah. That's the most important question to pose to people in some form or another, is how's that working for you? So we do it more sophisticatedly than that, but how's that working for you is a sublime intervention. What we do often is we'll have people write out like how the specific behaviors that they're doing, both mentally, emotionally, and physically. So write out some of your thoughts, feelings, and actions around this, and then look at them to see if they're helpful to you. So, but it's the same kind of thing. How's that working for you? And then what we lead people to, well, you know, if it's not working for you, then it doesn't make any sense to blame someone else, because your way of solving the problem is not working. That's not their fault. That's you not doing an experiment on your life to see, well, can we do something more effective? But I'm going to ask you to do that experiment now, and at a minimum, at least stop doing what doesn't work. So that's our way of containing that very deep question that you pose, which is at the heart of many, many people's resistance. Like, well, life is forcing me to adapt to it, and I'm still going to try to retain control and make life adapt to me.
I really appreciate you framing it up that way. And I just want to follow up with this question, because this is where I get stuck all the time in employing this model. I really love to get your take on, you know, do you think there's a hidden reward embedded in rumination, or in the parlance of forgive for good, like renting too much space in your mind? Some of the most challenging cases to me are when clients want to rehash a grievance repeatedly, despite all the education provided and having that precise discussion that you've just mentioned around, like, you know, that sort of essential, how's that working for you? And it's not, and they're going downhill and they're becoming depressed and losing sleep and maybe there's family disruption. What do you think's going on there? Why will people hang on to a sinking ship, if I can put it that way, as opposed to get in the life raft to go to a different island, which may be initially more uncomfortable, but why do people, in your experience or your conceptualization, want to stay in that sinking ship and not get off?
Well, of course, you know, you being a trained therapist, you know that whole idea of secondary gain from things. And you probably at least have heard of, I mean, I'm older, so I remember the whole games people play, Eric Byrne and transactional analysis, with all the gains that people get. But for the forgiveness work that we do, we try to keep things simple. And that's, I think, why you appreciated that book, because we really tried to make it applicable to almost anybody who had a sixth grade education. You know, you don't need a therapy degree. But the key element that I believe that unforgiveness serves a couple of functions, but the biggest function is I'm not responsible for my bad life stewardship. That a grievance allows us to try to place the blame for our inability to lead a happy life somewhere else. And that's the core function of it, that it's not my fault that I'm unhappy. It's not my fault that I'm unemployed. It's the fact that my parents didn't love me, or my lover dumped me, or my boss fired me. For most things, that's true. It's that it serves as a safety valve from really assessing how well it is we are steering our own ship of life. There are some situations where people have simply gone through catastrophic experiences or way outside of their coping capacity. So the grievance then is a simple, like, both reminder and a cry for help that this is seriously outside of my league. And so sometimes it can be a genuine, like, this blew me out of the water in every conceivable way. However, after a while, when you don't examine your coping, even though it blew you out of the water, so, you know, if you're 10 years old and your father gets hit by a truck, you know, that's going to disrupt your coping for a while. I mean, but if you're 25 and you're still saying that, well, I can't do X, Y, and Z because my father got hit by a truck, then you fall into the first category, because at some point you can recognize that I don't know how to do these things and I damn well better learn.
What are some signs that someone might be holding a grievance? I'll loosely say the pathological version of a grievance, right? Like, I want to be very clear. We're not talking someone who's fresh off a loss or something catastrophic that's happened to them, but someone where the statute of limitations is well past on, you know, how much responsibility they can continue to assign to that thing that happened to them. What are the signs that someone might be holding on to an unhealthy grievance of some kind?
One of the simplest responses we can give to anybody is remind them of the essential power of habit and the essential desire for the brain to create habit. And so even somebody with, you know, who's 50 and still telling it that the reason their life sucks is what happened when they were 9, a very kind of benign intervention is to remind people how desperately the nervous system and senses want to have habits around them, because there's too much information coming in and we need to have patterns to organize our way. And that the pattern that you created, you know, while maybe useful a long time ago, is probably not an optimal pattern now. But I try to avoid most sticky things with people. Like my methods are more teaching and like normalizing than anything else. So again, you know, you can remind almost anybody that, well, what you're doing now took a lot of practice to get there. And so that practice made you really good at this. That doesn't mean, though, it's the only thing that you could do. And it doesn't mean that being good at something guarantees that it's the best response for you. So then you can reframe opportunities for practice of something different. But like with the thing you referenced before, like that metaphor of, you know, renting space in your mind to a grievance, that's a really simple metaphor to give people to remind them that they're in control of the process. They're not necessarily in control of all the events and experiences. But that's what I try to work with, is the process. And try to help them see how active they are in the creation of the process. That's central to everything that the forgiveness method is about.
Well, I couldn't agree more. I think there is a lot of compassion in the model as articulated. And I think when I've seen clients do well with the model, which is quite frequently, the thing that's so beautiful about it is that there's a sense of empowerment and health and competency,
no question,
that flows from it. Like, people feel that they can be back in charge, even if things are very difficult. Like, they're competent and healthy in the way that they are relating to very challenging circumstances.
You know, one other piece that, again, if I'm like self-advertising on one piece, it's the very simplicity of like the PERT practice for calming down physically, unenforceable rules for simplifying CBT into like pablum, and like the positive intention for how to change the story. These are all simplifications of things that are well in use all over the field. But what we try to do is make them simple and available to people, and to substitute practice for discussion. So do something different, think differently, breathe differently, respond differently, give me a different story. So one of the things that we have done at times, and I remember doing this, is like challenging people sometimes even to make their story worse. You know, there's a famous teaching story by somebody named Shalom Aleichem, who is a Hebrew teacher or maybe Yiddish teacher, of like, you can make things worse to realize how good you have it now. So, you know, let's say you get rear-ended in a car accident and you hate the person who hit you. Well, you can, yes, and you want to tell people how bad it was. But then a therapeutic intervention would be just that, well, how could it have been worse? Well, so they rear-ended me, but they didn't kill me, or, you know, whatever. Or I was able to drive home or whatever. And so you're always trying to get people to realize the practice effect and how you can change what you practice anytime you want. So you can, you know, somebody hits you and you can say, they wrecked my car, I hate people. And you can say that five times. And then the sixth time you say, well, yeah, they wrecked my car, but I'm still fine. But it's always an engagement in practice rather than just a discussion of, yeah, there are a lot of people in the world, and there are, but what are you doing about your well-being in a world of rotten people?
Yeah, I think what would work, what probably works so well about that model is that it helps the brain to build concepts with more and more granularity and more flexibility.
Right.
Right. And we may not be responsible for the things that happen to us, but we are responsible for the concepts that we choose to bring to bear to situations. And we can learn and build and have more sophisticated, higher resolution ways of playing with these situations that come our way.
Exactly. And the emphasis on forgiveness is to describe it to some degree as a conduit to that better coping, not necessarily that it matters in and of itself, but that until this thing called forgiveness comes in, you're stuck. And you're usually stuck in bad coping. Forgiveness doesn't have that much to do with whatever the past was or whoever hurt you, but it's designed to facilitate much better coping on your part. That's crucial. And that's the benign, sectarian, non-sectarian way that we develop this. Like, why don't we just teach this as a secular method of a transition to better coping rather than a moral imperative or anything, because it's not owned by the religious traditions. It's a human trait that can be trained.
Yeah, it really frustrates me that this kind of knowledge is not translated better in society. It seems to me that things would go a whole lot better in many domains if this sort of mindset was able to be more percolating through the way that we think through things. I know, I think you might have undersold it a little bit in terms of its sophistication, but that notion of unenforceable rules, I think you described it as perhaps being Pavlov of some kind, but I think that notion of unenforceable rules is really incredibly important. And, you know, for folks who aren't familiar with the model, can you define what an unenforceable rule is and maybe some of the signs that we're trying to enforce one, and then maybe some of the consequences of that struggle?
Sure. I mean, I have to give full credit to rational emotive behavior therapy, where I was, as I mentioned to you, I spent 3 weeks at their institute in New York City one summer in the 90s. I had been a student of cognitive behavioral therapy since I began as a therapist. So it's not that anything was invented. What I tried to do was, how can we make this so dumb? Like, that was really my goal. Like, what I love about Albert Ellis's work rather than David Burns's work is Albert Ellis has basically one irrational or cognitive distortion, which he should. And, you know, David Burns has 10, and those are great, but people, you know, it's like one is easier to teach. And I tried to make that one even simpler, because I wasn't doing this therapeutically. I was trying to do this educationally. So an unenforceable rule to me was just a rule or expectation about something I don't have any control over. So it's like the serenity prayer, you know, like if I try to control stuff I don't control, I'm going to make myself miserable. So an unenforceable rule is, you know, you come home, your partner's drunk, and you tell them, well, my rule is you can't drink. And they look at you and they're drunk. So you can ask yourself, well, did I actually have any control over whether they drank or not? And the answer is no. So any rule or expectation that I have for that behavior is unenforceable. Like, I can have it, but it doesn't mean anything. the way we would teach this was we would remind people that, like, if you tell your two-year-old to stay in their crib, you can enforce it. If you tell your 18-year-old to stay in your crib, you can't enforce it. They can just climb out and walk out the door and tell you, hey, I don't care what you think. You can keep a two-year-old in a crib. So for a two-year-old, you stay there. That's an enforceable rule. For an 18-year-old, you stay there. That's not an enforceable rule. So when the two-year-old stays there, good. When the 18-year-old climbs out and you yell at them because you're not listening to my rule, you've escalated the situation out of proportion because you're making believe that you had a rule that was enforceable and that was a delusion in your mind. You misled yourself thinking that because I say they have to stay there, they have to stay there. So you were not properly informed, and so your thinking was off. That's what allowed you to get so upset when they left the crib. If you had been more clear thinking, you would have said to yourself, well, I got an 18-year-old here. He doesn't have to stay there. I'm going to actually have to talk to him. We're going to have to negotiate. I may have to listen. We may have to come up with a rule together. So much of the upset is often because we make believe we have control, then we punish people for breaking our rule, and it's all fantasy between our ears. That, to me, is the simplest definition of CBT I can come up with. But that's what we try to do with unenforceable rules, and it's very effective. It's very simple. So I remember when I began teaching this, and I would tell people, you know, you could get up. Like, often the classes were like 6 o'clock at night. And I remember saying, you know, things are in the day. I'd say, well, why don't you go outside and get really pissed if the moon comes out? And they'd say, well, why would I get pissed if the moon comes out? It always comes out at 6 o'clock at night or 7 o'clock. And I'd say, well, that's no different than telling a drunk they shouldn't drink, because a drunk drinks, a moon comes out. So you're wasting all of that passion and effort and presence on something you don't control. And you can spend 20 years saying the moon ruined my evening by coming out. And that's all based on the unenforceable rule concept, which you have to work with when you're upset with something. The crucial insight of rationally motivated behavior therapy is that ABCD conception, that, you know, A doesn't cause C consequence. A gets filtered through B, belief, which causes C consequence. And then you have to dispute it at D. So this is our absolute simplification of it. And it emerged from my training there. I mean, even though I have been doing this forever, it is so obvious that, and their key concept, which I share, is when you tell somebody that you have no control over, or you tell the past, which you had no control over, that it's wrong, you're just setting yourself up for suffering. That's the only thing you're doing.
I want to run an idea past you that I think builds a little bit on what you're saying, and I really appreciate it, the elaborated description of the unenforceable rules. So I've explained it to clients in this fashion, and I find that many clients, and I'm going to include myself in this in terms of trying to implement the model in my own life, experience a great deal of challenge in not enforcing these rules. Like they're so tempting to want to grab onto and to enforce. And I've often wondered if our unenforceable rules are reflections of schema, core beliefs, safety protocols that we use to mitigate threat, challenges to unresolved threats from the past, things like that. There seems to be some sort of upside to holding on to that rule as opposed to letting it go. And I find assessing people's unenforceable rules to be almost like a really valuable assessment tool in terms of how they're mapping the world and where the threat landscape is. They have sort of mapped things out. I guess, what do you think about that sort of idea of seeing unenforceable rules as being the tip of the iceberg of maybe a much deeper structure or worldview of the self, the world, and other people?
The real problem with unenforceable rules is that they keep us from seeing our life clearly. And let me explain that, because especially if you're holding on to a grievance. So my parents, they were supposed to love me more than they did. That's the unenforceable rule. Because you got parents, they did what they did, and now you're looking back on it and creating an argument with your own life, saying that my own life should have been a different life, that I'm the one who gets to choose it, not what actually unfolded. So right there, you're in a very difficult position because you're arguing with your own life and you're saying that the reality of my own life was wrong. But what that really does, what it really takes away, first of all, it reinforces a habit of complaint. And that, remember, everything we do is patterned. So if you create a basic argument against your parenting, then you're creating a foundation for arguing with your own life all over the place, which is never a successful strategy. But the deeper problem is, if you spend much of your time trying to get your unenforceable rules met, you miss all of the time that people do right by you. And so you lose perspective, you lose gratitude, you lose relationship satisfaction because you're spending effort in the wrong place. So if you have a marriage and there's like, five things that your partner does that drive you crazy. I've told you 400 times never to do this. I've told you 393 times. That's great. I mean, you want to stake out your territory. But if you spend too much energy on that, then you start to lose sight of all the ways that the partner does what you want. But even deeper than that, all the ways that the partner is kinder to you than you even merit. Like, you lose sight of you keep it as a transactional exercise when any marriage or long-term partnership has so much gratuitous kindness there that if you're paying too much attention to your grievances or your unenforceable rules, you're going to miss the beauty of your own life. And that's the deepest wounding of it. And that's what we see in our offices all the time. All these people consumed by grievances who miss the sunset or who miss their children or who miss whatever they miss. But that's its deepest devastation. And that's something that REBT does not talk about, because my training and my interest is as a positive psychologist. And so there's that whole aspect of cultivating the good, cultivating the positive, accentuating strength that I believe I added a little bit to REBT, but that's the dead end of it. And again, you want to remind people of what they're giving up, and not have all these arguments about whether my mother really meant to hurt me. Well, even if she meant it, you're 43. What difference does it make? take all that energy and bring it to your present life. Take it all and bring it now. Where are you now taking that habit and judging somebody harshly? Let's look at that situation right now. That's how I would do that. It doesn't matter at some level what happened 45 years ago. What happened, what matters is the patterns that you created that arose from that.
One of the more powerful concepts in the book for me is the personal versus the impersonal. I really, really like that. Yeah. But I find, again, clients can sometimes struggle with this, right? So very briefly, the personal would be, yes, your pain is real. It's happened to you. It's valid. On the other side, there's the impersonal, that if we zoom out and look at the human condition over the time scale of generations, you know, many, many people have lost parents or spouses or been aggrieved or things like that, right?
Right.
So in terms of finding the impersonal in the hurt that we've experienced, what are ways of approaching this that are not invalidating, but that also retain the benefit of connecting with the impersonal? So how do you skate that line?
Well, it's another yes and. It's that if you are only aware of the personal aspect of your woundedness, then you're going to suffer more than is needed. And you're going to limit your empathy. If you only have the impersonal, then you can become like disconnected. Then you can be somebody who says, well, that's just karma. You don't have to care. And you could not learn the lessons from it. So neither of them is of value alone. What is essential is being able to hold both. That, yes, this is an example of life's pain. And it did happen to me, and it's a particular flavor of pain. And I better well come to grips and understand my pain, but not get limited by my pain, that it's part of life's pain. So one of the ways that I explain that to people is I'll say, I hear your story of your husband cheating on you and leaving you for the Dallas Cowboy cheerleaders. Like, I hear that. And, it's a devastating experience after 20 years of marriage. It's devastating. And I hear that, but I also hear that, like, right now, there may be 50,000 people sitting in therapy offices in the state of California talking about their partner's affairs. So it's both intensely personal and common. So you don't give a shit about the other 49,999, and they don't give a shit about yours. So it's not the affair itself that's the problem. It's that it happened to you. When you see it clearly, you realize that it's a common human experience. So you've got to make some peace with it, and it's deeply personal because it's about you. You don't want to be stuck on either end. That's how I do that.
I really like that. It's like a dialectic. Like, both have to be able to be somewhat true at the same time on some level.
So much of this is a dialectic of, yes, it hurt like hell, and it's transcendable. Yes, it's a uniquely personal experience, and the same thing is happening right now and has always happened through every corner of this globe throughout history. It's the deepest question is, do you grow from this in empathy and compassion, or do you sink into victimhood? The event itself is common. The diverging roads are empathy and compassion for yourself and human suffering versus victimhood, that it's only me or my tribe that matter. Victimhood has not enriched the planet very much, but empathy and compassion have enriched the planet very much. And that's, to me, the dialectic that we're looking at.
in that vein, I feel that when clients are ready, they've benefited a lot from your model in the context of trauma. I found it to be particularly effective for instances where some kind of resolution is impossible because it might be unsafe, geographically impossible, someone important in the story has passed away. Can you speak to the applicability of your model to trauma? Is there a trauma-informed lens around using this model for those kinds of challenges?
I think for some people, it makes an approach like this very challenging. The sad thing about trauma is, they're now understanding that it's almost more related to the mental, social health of the person before the traumatic event than during. That, they've even shown that Vietnam War veterans who came from unstable homes or had all sorts of prior things, they were the ones who suffered more from PTSD. They found that, almost so many things that the level of differentiation and coping and emotional intelligence that one had going in was hugely predictive of who's going to have long-term traumatic consequences. So trauma itself doesn't actually exist. It's not like there's trauma. There's trauma times coping and capacity of people to handle things. So my thinking is, if somebody really has, just a devastating, chaotic childhood, and then they have an adult trauma, and they may be so whatever that a cognitive mindfulness narrative approach may not be the best one for them. I have no problem with that. On the other hand, many people say, because I've experienced trauma, forgiveness isn't appropriate. I think they're ridiculous. That, that people like me or Desmond Tutu or the Dalai Lama have all talked about, experienced, and shown that you can offer forgiveness from the worst things in life. That the degree of horror and negativity doesn't limit forgiveness. I mean, Desmond Tutu chaired the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. The Dalai Lama teaches his monks to forgive the Chinese. I've worked with people, from political violence to 9/11 to all sorts of things. So there's no data that would suggest forgiveness is inappropriate for trauma, but I would be cautious in people whose basic personality structure is disordered, separate from the traumatic experience.
Dr. Luskin, I want to give you the last word here in the conversation. What's maybe a message or two that you would like to leave the audience with?
The two points that I always try to make, because they're so simple, is that forgiveness is one of these things with research backing that is good for people. And it's not universally positive, but pretty close on the studies that look at it. You're going to be better off if you forgive. It's just a human truth, and it doesn't even matter what the offense is. It's that you're going to do better if you forgive. We did research projects with people who had their children murdered. So, that's as gritty as you get. Other people with marital things and parent things and, all sorts of stuff. So, one, it's good for you. Two, you can learn it. It's not esoteric. You don't have to believe in Jesus. You don't have to meditate and achieve Zen. You can learn to do this. You can practice it. That's wonderful. So sometimes the religious traditions have made it seem like it belongs to them. It does not. It's a human quality that we can develop and teach and learn. And I think that's my message to psychotherapists is You can teach this to people. You can instruct them. You can guide them. You can, you know, nudge them forward, because it's a tremendous boon to the human experience. If there was more forgiveness, this world would be in a far better place. The last thing that I say, and I mean this to psychotherapists, and one of the reasons that psychotherapists don't necessarily know that much about it is because they don't necessarily practice it in their own life. You can't tell somebody to do something you can't do. And so there's that famous Gandhi, you know, thing where this woman comes to Gandhi and says, you know, please tell my children to stop eating sugar. And Gandhi says, well, come back in 2 weeks. And the woman comes back in 2 weeks and he tells the kids not to eat sugar. And the woman said, why'd you wait? Make me wait 2 weeks? And he said, 2 weeks ago, I was eating sugar. But with forgiveness, because it's outside the box, it's very hard to have credibility if you don't do it. So that's my caveat to therapists is, you know, practice it yourself. Practice compassion. Practice gratitude. Practice seeing the good. And then you'll want to teach it to your patient. So those would be the three kind of, I'm going to say, wrap-up comments those are the summative things that I've ended up with after all these years.
No, I want to put a plug in for Forgive for Good in that model with respect to clinicians. I think managing burnout, I found it to be a hugely valuable platform and tool for managing my own emotions and regulating myself as I pass throughout my day. I mean, clinical work, let's face it, it's difficult. You're confronting human limitations, both in your clients and in yourself all day. You know, you're dealing with serious problems that people have not been able to handle on their own for a variety of reasons. So it can be a very frustrating, invalidating, demoralizing undertaking. It can also be really beautiful, empowering, and just a transformative sort of undertaking. But I find what I've really liked about therapy as a human being is it presses all of my buttons, and it's forced me to develop coping to deal with all that stuff that comes up. And I have to say the forgiveness model has been a massively helpful tool for managing a lot of my, I think, unresolved stuff that comes up in the context of these complex human interactions that we engage with our clients.
You know, I'm going to say two more things. One is when I began this, I remembered the almost like central injunction of spiritual practice, separate from any religion, is, you know, you want to quiet your mind and open your heart. Like that's the central injunctions of spiritual practice. And one of the things I tried to do with the forgiveness thing, because I knew it was at some level a spiritual ideal that you can teach secularly, was, you know, quiet your mind. Well, that's what CBT does. Quiet your mind. Open your heart. That was the heart-centered practices. You know, like, I simply tried to take other people's thinking and direct it towards forgiveness, because forgiveness was neglected. The last thing I'm going to say, and then I'm going to actually go have dinner, is people don't understand the deep value of forgiveness at all. Because if you look at our world, most of the violence, most of the harshness, most of the mistreatment arises because of a lack of forgiveness. Because even in our partnerships, our spouses, our business partners, if we feel that we've been harmed and we haven't forgiven them, then we use that as permission to harm them. So, you know, your partner says something nasty to you, you hold a grudge. You then defend your being nasty back. Or you then give yourself permission, well, she was such a shit, so I'm not going to listen to her. But when you realize that that's happening all over the world, in individuals, groups, tribes, cultures, the United States, Republicans and Democrats, you're seeing it every day, everywhere, a lack of forgiveness and a defending of our own unkindness because unkindness was shown to us. So I don't believe that this world has even begun to touch the importance of forgiveness in terms of world healing and world peace. But that's how I saw it. That this is the conduit.
No, I completely agree. There's a fabulous book, which I've mentioned on the podcast before, called Mistakes Were Made, But Not By Me. And they talk about that process of self-justification. Like you're at that 50-50 point of, you know, you could go either way. And once you go down that part of the pyramid towards self-justification, it gets worse and worse and worse because you have to continue to justify all the actions that you took before, right? Like I would only be mean to a mean person. So they must be really mean, right? And then of course it just amplifies.
And so if and when you forgive even something small, you're making a small contribution to world peace. I do believe that.
Well, Dr. Luskin, thanks so much for carving out a bit of time to speak with me today. It's been such a treat to speak directly with the author of one of the books that I use most frequently and recommend to clients. I can't recommend the book highly enough. If you're a clinician, if you're a mental health consumer, I really, really recommend Forgive for Good. It's great. I think you'll get a lot of it personally and professionally. So again, Dr. Luskin, thank you so much for coming on, and I wish you all the very best.
Thank you.
Well, I really hope that you enjoyed the podcast as much as I did. If you found value in the show, we'd appreciate a rating on iTunes. Or if you'd simply tell a friend about the show, that would help us out too. And now for the mandatory disclaimer. This podcast represents the opinions of Dr. Kelly and that of his guests. Content of the podcast should not be taken as psychological advice and is for general information only. Please consult your mental health professional for any specific questions around your psychological health. In no way does listening to our content establish a psychologist-client relationship. While we make every effort to ensure that the information we are sharing is accurate, we welcome any comments, suggestions, or corrections of errors. All people, places, and scenarios mentioned in the podcast have been changed to protect patient confidentiality. Finally, this podcast should not be used in any legal capacity whatsoever, including but not limited to establishing a standard of care in a legal sense or as a basis for expert witness testimony. No guarantee is given regarding the accuracy of any statements or opinions made on the podcast.